the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that if we were in a haunted room reading a book, we'd be like, leave me alone, ghost, I'm reading.
Yeah, come on, ghost. It's rude to look over someone's shoulder.
I hate waiting to have to turn the page. Jeez.
I'm reading weird scrawled handwriting on the margin of a Bible or something.
So, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And this week we read Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Indeed we did. A classic tale of ghosts and love and revenge and orphans.
Passion.
And puppies.
Being hanged.
Sometimes being hanged and sometimes biting someone on the ankle and ruining everything.
True. Yeah, is the real moral of this story that dogs are the worst?
Bulldogs are assholes.
Did Emily Bronte have the scenes of puppy hanging just because she was like, fuck dogs?
She was a cat person.
Like dogs that makes sense.
Dogs are weird and slobbery. Bit Kathy's ankle, laid her up at the Linton's house. If they just had cats, everyone would have been fine.
So can we safely say that Emily Bronte, because all of her dogs, you know, are terrible, is a cat person, but Charlotte Bronte, because of Pilot, Rochester's dog, she is a dog person.
Hmm, could be true. It might have been some sibling conflict there.
I actually, just on the topic, because it's a Bronte, I guess, I watched a recent adaptation of Jane Eyre, and Pilot did not show up until the very end, which I was quite upset about. And when Pilot did show up at the end, he was like this, like, 40-pound, like, terrier-type dog. And I was like, excuse me.
Bitch, please.
That is not what Pilot looks like. I'm sure I'm the only person who, like, got mad at that movie because the dog was the wrong breed, but whatever.
I don't know. The people, I know some dog people, and obsessive dog people are can be pretty pedantic about their breeds.
I'm going to start a angry online petition.
There you go.
So, anyway, Wuthering Heights. So, we read this book because it's a classic. A lot of people read it in school, but Ben and I had somehow managed to go through all of our years of school without ever having read it. I actually bought a copy of it in high school, and about 3 weeks ago looked at it on the shelf and said, you know, I guess it's time I read Wuthering Heights. So,
yeah, for those of you who don't intimately know our respective biographies, high school was not especially recent at this point.
Yeah. I am coming up on my 10-year high school reunion, yeah. So.
There you go.
I've had that book for a while. So one of the reasons we're doing it is because I read it and then told Ben he should read it so we could podcast it. But also, one of the interesting things I thought about for this book is that before I read it, one of the things I always heard about it was just that it was, like, this great love story. And I particularly remember talking to some people who said, well, you don't want to read Wuthering Heights as a love story. You want to read it as a love story between two terrible people. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I guess when I read the book, I'm going to make sure to think of the two main characters as, like, terrible people. Like, thinking that I would kind of have to, like, come at the book from a new angle. And then when I read it, I was like, how is that a surprise? Everyone in this book is terrible. Yeah. Like,
there is literally one angle, and that is the angle of everybody in the book is a terrible person.
Yeah, and I don't know how it's been marketed for years as a classic love story, because in my opinion, the love story is, like, practically not there. Yeah. I was shocked that that's what everyone talks about when it was, like, in 10 pages of the book.
I very much had the same thought, because I have only ever heard Wuthering Heights referenced as a love story. I believe the newest movie adaptation that I somehow came across a trailer or commercial for described it as a multi-generational love story or something like that. And okay, man, whatever you want to say, but...
Yeah, I looked up the 2012 version, and the tagline for that version was, "Love is a force of nature."
Okay, sure, why not? Hurricane love, here to kick your ass.
I guess.
I was telling Gabs just a few minutes ago that I don't know how many copies of this book have been sold historically, but it's been around for a long time, so maybe it should be... Wuthering Heights, now up to 1.1 million disappointed readers. Gotta be people like, I'm gonna read this classic tale of romance, and it'll be a wonderful love story, and it'll be touching and interesting, and what the hell, what is happening?
What is this book?
I don't even know. So, yes. The plot synopsis for this book is therefore a classic love story without any love story in it.
Yeah, which I love. I think it's 100% accurate. I'm gonna have to tweet that from Classic Sum Up.
Oh,
actually.
That's a good Classic Sum Up tweet.
Yeah. So for genre of the book, you know, like Ben likes to do, he said it's a classic. Because that's a kind of a genre in and of itself.
I just do it because I like it when Gabs tells me to shut up.
The other genre you came up with that I liked was unlikable characters. Mostly because unlikable characters sort of is a modern day genre. I think like one of the hip new things to do is write a book with a ton of unlikable characters in it. So I kind of am thinking of Wuthering Heights as like a hipster version of the unlikable character genre.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, the anti-hero or even kind of, I guess, anti-villain protagonist is very, very popular. And anymore, if you write a story with just a straight-up heroic character in it, the people go, oh, straw protagonist, who cares?
Yeah. Like, oh, it's a hero with no flaws.
Which I can understand, but there's definitely a fine line between here's a complex heroic character versus a hero who is only a hero by accident of circumstance and is otherwise a terrible person, or for that matter, the classic Silver Age Superman no flaws whatsoever character.
Yeah, and we actually had a discussion in one of my classes recently about you can have a character with flaws and still have them be a likable person.
Well, yeah, that too.
Because otherwise everyone on Earth would just be an unlikable douchebag. Well, which, I mean, might be the case, but...
Depending on where you're coming from, yes. I was going to say a lot of YA protagonists have a flaw that keeps them from being a fully functional human being for part or all of their book, but they're usually still pretty likable.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So the other genre that I thought Wuthering Heights might be able to fall into is romance with a capital R, not in the sense that it's based around a romance. Just because there is a little bit of, like, the wildness of the moors that they live on and, like, the sweeping passions and the whatever. I thought it kind of fit the bill, but I honestly, like, thought the book was a bit more sterile than, like, crazy, sweeping, and passionate like I was expecting it to be. So I hesitate a little bit to put it into that category, but I think, like, in general, people would not fight you if you called it a romance with a capital R.
Right, like a romance in the same sense as Frankenstein, for example.
Yeah, yeah. Or even maybe Jane Eyre a little bit.
Yeah. Or I was going to throw the word gothic out there.
Yeah, yeah. I think gothic is fair. So, you might be, like, wondering what the hell the book is about now, since we're, like, it's nothing like what you expected. So just to kind of give you, like, a very brief general idea, Heathcliff is picked up by Kathy's father while he's out on, like, a business trip, basically. Comes home because he was an orphan. So Heathcliff and Kathy, who are, like, the two names you've heard, are raised together. But then at some point as a teenager, she meets the Lintons, which is, like, another family in the area. And they're, like, the epitome of, like, proper British gentle people. And becomes friends with them. So she ends up actually marrying Edgar, the son of that family, despite the fact that she also loves Heathcliff, because Heathcliff, like, runs off in, like, a pissy whatever. Anyway, Heathcliff comes back, super angry about it. He and Kathy, like, connect in this passionate moment, and then she, like, dies of it, as far as we can tell, but not before giving birth to a daughter also named Kathy. Heathcliff has run off with Edgar's sister and had a kid with her, but she runs away, and then, like, the kids end up getting embroiled in this, like, extreme revenge plan that Heathcliff has. He, like, forces a bunch of people to be imprisoned and die and marry each other, blah, 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 blah. I just don't feel like going into the details of that. And then eventually at the end, Kathy's daughter ends up at Wuthering Heights. Heathcliff is dead, and she's going to, like, start a new life with her cousin.
I like how you end that with kind of a disgusted trail off there. And then she'll start her new life with her cousin.
Yeah, when Ben and I were discussing this book, I actually didn't realize that Harriton, this guy she ends up marrying, was her cousin. I was just like, oh yeah, like, that romance was kind of cute. And then I was like, wait, Harriton was the son of her... they're cousins.
It was like they were sneakily cousins.
Yeah, and then I was like, damn it, England.
Damn it, classic fiction. Why do you have so much cousin fucking?
Yeah, so as if you couldn't tell, the setting is England. It's in the wild moors of England, apparently. And one of the things that I added is that it's set in hell, just because so many of the contemporary critics of the book at the time, since it was published in Victorian England, the passions and the violence were very shocking to people who lived at that time, and they were all completely baffled by it. So I really liked this quote by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who said that Wuthering Heights was a fiend of a book, an incredible monster. The action is laid in hell. Only it seems places and people have English names there.
Which is wonderfully English.
Yes. But, I mean, fair enough. Like, Heathcliff is a horrible monster, and a lot of the other people in the book suck. So I think saying the book is set in hell is, like, not that far out there.
I think saying that it's set on the moors might be some sort of period shorthand as well. A couple months ago, I read The Hound of the Baskervilles, which also takes place on the moors, and, like, kind of the wildness and the just danger of walking alone out there. There were some additional setting details in that book that don't apply to this one necessarily, but those were points that were repeatedly emphasized in that book.
Yeah.
So, like...
Oh, go ahead.
So to say, like, the idea of this hellhound running around, or of Heathcliff, who is a bit of a hellhound himself, running around on the moors.
Very true.
Yeah, maybe not entirely out of the question.
The other thing is that the Brontes themselves sort of lived, like, out in the moors, like, far away from human society, so there's also that element of it, I think.
Yeah, a little bit of the autobiographical thing.
Yeah.
Alright, so the point of view intents of this story is complex, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's fair.
Ostensibly, the story is being told by a gentleman named Lockwood, who gives us a first-person account of what he's doing for about a chapter or two, and then basically, like, the overwhelming majority of the rest of the book is him relaying Nellie, the housekeeper, her version of this story, with occasional flashbacks nestled within that, even.
Yes. And Nellie also sometimes is relaying letters from another character, Isabella, just like reading the letter. So then you kind of have Nellie narrating Isabella being narrated by Lockwood.
Yeah, there was a chapter, or maybe it was a set of chapters, but Lockwood was convalescing from an illness. And so the first paragraph of a chapter is, I will tell you the rest of Nellie's story briefly, and then there's a little line break, and then start speaking from the first person's perspective again, but it takes a few sentences before it's obvious that it's actually Nellie's first person and not Lockwood's.
Yeah.
And it was within that set of chapters that it got to, oh, well, Isabella sent this letter, and then that letter starts again speaking from the first person, and it takes a minute to realize that, oh no, this is actually supposed to be the verbatim contents of Isabella's letter from the first person. I was very confused for a few pages.
And you know, a simple formatting choice could fix that, because in my version, the letter was in italics, so I knew right away.
Hey man, the power of the power of page setting or something.
Yeah. Oh, I could tell you all about it.
I'm sure you could.
But we won't get into it. Yeah, so it's a little confusing at times. I mean, it really is like Lockwood, who's in the modern day, trying to wonder, like, he's trying to figure out what the hell is up with Wuthering Heights and the people who live there. And then Nellie is telling him, like, the story of Heathcliff as a kid, and then, you know, jumps forward. It was a little confusing because she, like, jumps forward 13 years, and I didn't know if they, how close they were to the present day until she's like, oh, all of this happened, like, 6 months ago.
Yeah, so that was also a little bit tough to follow for just a moment.
Yeah. And in the foreword to my book, the person who wrote, like, the little intro essay claimed that this, like, style of narration added to the, like, dreamlike feel of the book, and they thought it was a very powerful choice that, like, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, oh, whatever.
So if you were hired to write the intro to some classic that you had some level of expertise with, presumably, and you write your intro to go, this is a weird book that has weird stuff in it, and that may not be a good thing. They probably don't publish that, I'm guessing.
True.
So you have to look for reasons to justify its existence.
I also thought it was interesting, though, because, like, in my opinion, like, having Lockwood come in and, like, see weird stuff and then be like, what happened? And then have someone tell him what happened. Like, that's not that unusual for a book written around this time. Like, when we read The Scarlet Letter, the opening
right.
of that was, like, this huge story about this guy going to a place and then, like, hearing the story of The Scarlet Letter.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, or, like, in Phantom of the Opera, the first part's like, oh, I found, like, these old papers in this opera house telling about this story. So, like, people, for whatever reason around that time, were very obsessed with, like, kind of framing stories like that. So I didn't think it was that unusual, honestly.
I guess unusual, is one thing, because it's not particularly unusual from what I've seen of 19th century literature. It's modern chauvinism, perhaps, but I think if it's really so much weirdness going on, it would be a more interesting way to tell the story just to have Lockwood immersed in it.
Yeah. Or to have, like, really weird, unreliable narrators, like have Heathcliff and Kathy narrating.
Oh, yeah, that would be... Okay, so here you go. If you want a way to do an interesting modern adaptation, have one where chunks of it are told from the points of view of the characters you don't get to hear from in the book.
Yeah. Especially the characters that you hate, because Heathcliff is... I mean, I despise him, and...
Yeah, what the hell is
telling part of the story would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, what the hell is he thinking?
Yeah. I don't know. You don't need to sympathize with him, but hearing from his point of view might be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you can follow a character around who is unsympathetic and still get good stuff out of him.
Yeah.
So... I mean, I guess this would be a good time to start discussing the characters real briefly. Which one of them is the protagonist?
Yeah, so this one's tough, because Heathcliff is obviously supposed to be despised by the reader. Like, he is not supposed to be an honorable person in any sort of the word. So he can't really be the protagonist. And then a lot of the other characters, like... Catherine Earnshaw, she, you know, dies about halfway through, so that doesn't really work. Like, her daughter, maybe a little bit, but she's not in the first half of the book. So, it's, like, really kind of baffling, because none of the characters really seem to fit the bill.
Yeah, I mean, you basically have narrators, and then one evil guy, and then a shifting cast. So,
yeah.
So this is probably a no-tagonist scenario, as we have said in the past.
Yeah, which is a great word, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's one of our better terms we've coined, I think. If nothing else comes out of all these podcast episodes, I would wear that. If that could get into the mainstream lexicon, I would just own that.
Well, with that said, we can go ahead and talk about some of the prominent characters, even though we don't really think any of them... I mean, I guess Heathcliff is the most prominent character, but he's definitely not a protagonist.
Yeah, so why don't you do some Heathcliff ranting at the top here?
Well, Heathcliff... So one of the things I showed on the outline is Heathcliff is the literal devil. Basically, from the time he shows up, he's just a little asshole. Part of it was he was, like, neglected as a kid, so I don't know if that's part of it. But he, like, kind of attaches himself to Kathy and decides he likes her, and he's gonna, like, hate everyone else. But then, you know, like, if she kind of defies him, then he hates her, too, and then she hates him back. And that whole thing is going on. But after that, his, like, whole life just kind of becomes this insane revenge plot. But he does it in really weird ways. Like, he takes Hareton, who's, like a nephew-ish type person to him, and is like, you know what, I'm just not going to teach him to read, because I think it would be funny if he was just, like, a complete savage. And I'm going to, like, kidnap these women and lock them in the house and force them to marry people against their will. And I'm going to hang a puppy in a tree for funsies. Like, that's who Heathcliff is.
He, like, shows these moments of behavior that we would probably consider to be psychopathic now.
Yeah.
And I doubt that was really a concept in Victorian times.
I don't really know when the psychopath thing came about.
Yeah. Certainly in a modern story, if you have someone who is a bad character doing something like hanging a puppy, that's a pretty clear message, because that's like that's very much a modern trope, is killing animals equals future serial killer.
Yeah. Well, and Heathcliff also has this, like, weird ability to turn everyone around him into an asshole, because, like, so for example, he has Nellie, the maid, and Kathy's daughter, who's also named Kathy, by the way, come over to his house, and like, once he gets them in and closes the door, he's like, haha, you can't leave now. And he locks Nelly in a room, like, doesn't give her any food or anything. She's pounding on the door, trying to force her way out. And, like, finally, the maid there, Zilla, like, comes up to the door and is like, here's some food. And she's like, let me out. What's going on? And she's just like, not my business. Like, locks the door and walks off. And it's just shocking, like, how once people get to Wuthering Heights, like, they are so willing just to let other people, like, be miserable, starve, like, get attacked by dogs. Like, no one cares. It's, I don't know if, like, Heathcliff has some sort of, like, apathy hate ray or something that he's, like, able to encompass everyone with, but, like, once you're in that house, you just don't give a shit.
Yeah, like, some sort of hate aura that he's giving off, maybe. Because, like, his presence causes Hindley to decay from gentleman into insane drunk person. Harriton, just by living in the same house, turns from proper English gentle child into savage. Isabella goes from flighty teenager who thinks she's in love with the tall, dark, handsome guy into, like, miserable shell of herself within, like, a week of moving there.
Yeah.
Kathy, the younger, moves in and it goes from vibrant, like, everybody loves her, gets all these, like, great life energy vibes off of her, into this just sullen, bitter woman who is probably, like, 17 when Lockwood meets her, but you would assume is, like, 37.
Yeah. Is she, like, 18 tops?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't know. Maybe Wuthering Heights is a haunted house in terms of, like, the Heathcliff's, like, evil energy just, like, sucks the lifeblood out of everyone and turns them into dicks.
Yeah, like, if it was animated, you'd expect to see, like, a weird black pulsing aura around it when people walked up to it.
Totally. So, one other thing I wanted to mention about Heathcliff, though, so I was kind of, like, vaguely reading up on the book a little bit, just because I was, like, so baffled by it when I finished, and one of the things I've seen is that Wuthering Heights is a cautionary tale about the dangers of having too much passion, and so, like, you know, one of the things that you could say about Heathcliff is that he's too passionate, and the passion drives him to madness, kind of thing. So, I don't know, Ben, what do you think about that?
I think that, I mean, to me that sounds like a traditional literary criticism English class sort of comment. Where it's like, well, we're studying this book and this is what, you know, this is what people said about it that kept it being read for however many years it needed to kept being read before it could become a curriculum book. And I mean, Heathcliff has too much passion in the sense of being like someone prone to violently lashing out, I guess. I certainly would not have walked away from this book with, like, too much emotional passion as a theme or a thread, even. Like, I would not have come up with that on my own, I think, in 100 years.
But older Kathy basically dies of too much passion, I guess.
Right, and I was thinking we might actually kind of look at some of these other characters through that lens, at least briefly, to see what we come up with, because I agree. Kathy the Elder, as a child, is kind of like this wild, tomboyish, runs around the moors with Heathcliff. They're you know, they're best pals, and gets her leg halfway chewed off by the Linton's bulldog, and so while she's laid up there, they somehow civilize her in, like, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
and she ends up marrying blonde pretty boy Edgar Linton, but still has these feelings for Heathcliff, apparently, and no sooner do we, the reader, find that out than she's dying, it seems.
Yeah, that whole scene was so odd. Like, when Heathcliff shows back up, and Edgar punches him, and then Kathy falls ill of something, and then she's, like, locked up, and then Heathcliff comes back, and they're like, we love each other, and then he leaves, and she's like, if you leave, I'm gonna die, and he's like, I just have to leave for, like, 2 hours, and he leaves, and then she, like, immediately dies.
And this illness is like this feverish madness, so maybe that could be linked to passion in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I guess I just kind of read it as, like, the Victorian, like, oh, they have a weird fever, and their mind is messed up. Like the thing Jonathan got in, Harker got in Dracula.
Right.
Like, brain fever.
Yes.
Just kind of that vague, yeah, she's dying of a random fever.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell, and I mean, the concept of illness in this book is definitely not a modern concept of illness.
Yeah, I did think it was interesting. So you get no indication whatsoever that she's pregnant, and then Nellie said, oh, well, before she died, at least she managed to give birth to her daughter.
See, now that was what was... That was another one of the things that confused me, caught me off guard, because I was going, oh, she's sick, and I don't know if I'm trying to remember what the sequence exactly was in the book. I must have picked it up from some outside source, but I was like, I think there's supposed to be a kid involved, and then all of a sudden there was, but yeah, no mention of pregnancy.
Yeah, so that led me to think, I mean, you know, it's not proper for Victorians to talk about pregnancy and sex. Although Emily Bronte breaks all the other rules, so it's kind of odd it's not mentioned in this one, but I did kind of think, okay, so does Kathy, she must love Edgar somewhat, like, if they're gonna have a kid, they seem fairly happy together, like, it can't be Heathcliff's kid, because he just showed up when she was already pregnant.
Yeah, Edgar and Kathy were doing fine initially.
Yeah.
And then Heathcliff's weird hate aura screwed things up.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is.
If Heathcliff hates you, you just die of it. That's what happens in this book. you know, Edgar is definitely more of a proper British gentleman.
Oh, yes.
And he is not really the passionate type. If that's what we're basing characters on.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I thought about Edgar is, he's, you know, very genteel and kind. He loves to read, which, of course, we like about him. And then Nellie mentions at some point that she thought the Lintons, Edgar and his sister Isabella, were just, you know, kind of weak of spirit and, like, not as spirited and passionate and as Kathy, but she kind of said it like it was a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like, that their spirits would be broken if they were forced into circumstances. Which I thought was kind of interesting. Especially because I didn't think Edgar was particularly weak. But maybe it was just more he's weak because he has trouble letting his emotions go.
He's trouble just telling Heathcliff to fuck off and die, which is what someone in his position really probably should have done at some point.
Yeah.
Just like, what are you doing? Go away. Get off my property. Never come back.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked by the lack of, like, And I guess back then people weren't necessarily like, I'll call the police. But, I mean, this was, like, a super rich guy. He's like, I'm going to hire, like, 12 bodyguards to stand around my house, and if you show up, they're going to beat the shit out of you.
Well, it's mentioned he was a magistrate. He was the cops.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. So, yeah. Why didn't he have, like, his team of bobbies, like, protecting his house and,
right.
like, throwing Heathcliff in prison?
Get this guy out of here. I don't know. Maybe that was the weakness. I mean, if you want to see, I guess, the logical extension of this weakness of spirit on the Linton family, then Linton, first name Linton, last name Heathcliff, which is confusing as hell, Edgar's nephew, who is the weakest character, the most pampered, obnoxious, spoiled, whiny piece of crap. It's like, okay, Isabella was in this weird, like, semi-exile because she wasn't going to hang around Wuthering Heights with Heathcliff, but Edgar was pissed off at her for marrying Heathcliff, and even though she left, he wasn't going to help her, so she's off in London making it on her own and raising this sickly, whiny, like, leech of a son.
Yeah, I just thought that was so odd, because when Isabella, like, finally attacked Heathcliff and ran off, I thought that was so cool. And then she, like, yeah, she goes to London and makes it on her own, which is also really cool, and then she just raises this piece of shit son. I don't know how she managed to do that.
Well, and he, you know, and he comes back and is taken into the Heights, where Heathcliff kind of gets his weird hate aura magic going with him, too, except his character doesn't really change all that much once he's under that influence. His just, I mean, maybe at worst he's just more manipulative with it.
Yeah, I mean, Linton's main thing is that he just wants, like, people to like him, and he wants to be comfortable.
Yeah.
So if Heathcliff, you know, is going to make him uncomfortable, he's basically going to do anything he needs to do so that he can be comfortable again. Even if it means imprisoning a woman in his home.
Right?
Yeah.
Imprisoning a woman he's allegedly in love with in his home?
Allegedly.
Yes. So Kathy the younger, who was imprisoned in the home and who saw something in Linton, so she's kind of she's really supposed to be Linton's opposite, I think, because she's like lively and vivacious, and people, well, not very many people get to meet her, which is part of it too, but there are people who do, like, immediately, even Lockwood meeting, like, the bitter shell of herself aversion was interested immediately, right?
Yeah, he was like, well, maybe I could marry her.
Right. So she's pretty, and she gives off some kind of, she makes some sort of impression on people. And, you know, maybe this is where, maybe this is where Edgar has some weird version of Heathcliff of his own going on in him, like, kept her so sheltered and, like, effectively imprisoned on the grounds her whole life that the second...
Yeah.
The second she meets someone roughly her age, no matter what a callow piece of crap they are, she immediately is like, someone new, I love them.
Yeah. Well, she would have loved Hareton, except that he was too much of a bumpkin.
Right. And she was a little too self-absorbed to realize it wasn't his fault.
Yeah. But, yeah, If you think of everyone as an unlikable character, I actually think the younger Kathy is possibly one of the more likable characters, because even when she's kind of being a brat, you can kind of understand, like, she loves her father, but if you're basically forced to live on the grounds of your home your entire life and can occasionally walk a mile out with the, you know, company of your father, and not by yourself, that you might be like, hey, maybe there's other stuff in the world I can go see. So I don't really blame her for running off and trying to meet new people, and
sure,
you know, the love affair between her and Linton is mostly a dastardly plan of Heathcliff's anyway, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were going to adapt her into a movie with a modern setting, then she and her dad, her dad would basically be the cluelessly protective dad from 10 Things I Hate About You. You know, these days you don't so much imprison your teenage daughter on the grounds of your estate, but you could certainly you can certainly have a GPS on her phone and be bothering her all the time and harassing all the potential boyfriends away and whatnot.
Yeah, and then as far as other characters go, I feel like we should probably just mention Joseph, just because I know Ben wants to mention Joseph.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to Joseph's character. He's just kind of like an angry country bumpkin moralizer, I think, would be the way to put it.
Yeah, I think the most standout thing about Joseph is that his dialogue is written...
Holy cow.
And I guess in the local dialect, I don't really know how accurate it is to like how those people would speak, but nigh unreadable.
Oh yeah, I mean, just the first couple times he spoke, I was trying to dig out what he was saying. My addition, a couple of the weirdest words within that dialect would be translated, but the actual phrases would not be. And so, you know, it kind of got to a point by about the fifth time Joseph had dialogue that I pretty much just imagined he was saying, "You're a bad person and you should feel bad." Because that seems to be the gist of it.
In the version that I read, they helpfully translated all of Joseph's dialogue at the bottom of the page in, like, regular English. And that's, like, basically what he said, so you weren't really missing much.
Yeah, I mean, if I was going to make the modern movie version of him, I would have him be a character with just, like, a gigantic chaw of tobacco in his mouth so you can't understand a goddamn word he's saying.
Totally.
Yeah.
He's the Boomhauer of
yeah, that's right. Or is there a prison people in there in your kitchen and ask you out and have some dogs? What?
Totally. Yeah, so after all of that, like, there's a lot of stuff going on, and when we were thinking about, like, moral issues of the book, because I was really thinking, you know, okay, like, what's going on in this book? What are some of, like, maybe the redeeming values of it? Because when I finished reading it, I was just so confused, and I was, like, trying to figure out, like, what the hell is going on in this book? So kind of some of the thoughts I had about it after the fact, is that it could potentially be a critique of Victorian values, because even though the characters who are not acting like proper Victorians are very unlikable, the forthright way in which Emily Bronte dealt with emotion and violence and passion was very shocking to people at the time. And, you know, maybe they were too violent and passionate, but at the same time, maybe she was saying, hey, you know, you might pretend to be a proper person who is the most civilized human who has ever walked the earth, but to some degree, like, we all have maybe a little bit of this Heathcliff in us.
Yeah, maybe if you just admit to some of your feelings and emotions every once in a while, you can feel less of this weird, like, repressed rage inside.
And maybe we should be talking about emotions and violence in the world, because another thought, excuse me, that I had, I kind of saw some, like, proto-feminist like, threads in it, because a lot of the, like, the way that women ended up in the book, I thought were kind of maybe the result of the Victorian lifestyle. So, like, Isabella marries Heathcliff, even though she definitely shouldn't have, but maybe it was because she was, you know, sheltered and didn't know anything about the world and doesn't know, like, how men work. And
well, that's definitely
Kathy Earnshaw, the older Kathy, like, when she was a kid and was kind of sassy and tomboyish and, like, running around and talking back to people, like, those are traits that made the people around her think she was terrible. But, you know, that doesn't sound that bad to a modern reader, and maybe if she had been allowed to actually be herself, that would have been an okay thing. So I was thinking that maybe if Victorians actually talked about stuff, then maybe the women in the book wouldn't have ended up in, like, these horrible situations.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can, Kathy the Younger certainly had that naivete and lack of agency in her life up to the point that we really start getting to know her, that affected her choices, or lack of choices, really, more accurately.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, there probably is, we were kind of kicking the idea around of an interpretation of this book where if Kathy the Elder never gets her ankle bit by that asshole bulldog, maybe she and Heathcliff end up together, and the two of them are whatever passes for happy in their weird world, and no one else ever gets sucked into any of it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, there are those 17 Heathcliff children running around the moors, implying that they're fucking, like, bunnies constantly around the clock, I guess. And they're all a bunch of weird a-holes, but they're self-contained. They don't really bother anybody.
Or, on the other hand, would, if Kathy and Heathcliff had been able to get married, would they have, like, destroyed each other?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you don't walk away from the book feeling like Heathcliff's capacity for love could ever be used in a way that was beneficial.
Yeah, like, even when he's like, Kathy, I love you, like, finally admits it, it's still kind of, there's still, it's really weird.
Well, yeah, because he's like, I love you, and why the hell didn't you just know that and reject the rest of the world, you slut?
Yeah!
He's like, what?
That's a fair thing to say to someone.
Yeah, that's not okay.
The other thing going on in this book that I thought was really odd was, so it is shocking and violent and everyone's crazy, and for as much as Emily Bronte is saying, like, here are all these things that make you uncomfortable, one of the things that she never brings up, which is very Victorian of her, is sex. So, you know, Ben said if you see, like, the 17 Heathcliff children running around, you're like, oh, okay, I know what's going on there. But it was really odd because Isabella and the older Kathy both get pregnant, seemingly, you know, by will of spirit or something.
Right.
Pregnancies are never mentioned, and then all of a sudden, like, just, oh, there's a kid, all right, moving on. And you never get any indication of if the characters are having sex, anything that's going on there. And the interesting thing about that is because Heathcliff is such a terrible, violent person, and Isabella hates him, like, from day three of their marriage, like, we were wondering, how exactly did she get pregnant? And is there, like, horrible sexual assault going on in this house that's just, like, totally glossed over?
Yeah, because it's pretty much stated that, I mean, in Isabella's letter, she pretty much said by, like, the second day she hated Heathcliff.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like she'd be really willingly sleeping with him at that point. And I was, you know, one of my theories as I was reading the book was that Kathy the Elder's kid would turn out to be Heathcliff's or something. And then as I kept reading, I was like, oh no, what am I, where am I going with this? Like, they're never going to admit that sex was actually happening.
Yeah. Not ever.
So yes, in this world, women just suddenly become, just are suddenly pregnant right before they need to give birth because the child is convenient to the plot.
Yeah. I think that's basically it.
It seems to be how biology works in Victorian England.
It was interesting, though, that there's, like, so much of this other stuff going on, and then that part is just entirely sanitized.
Yeah, because some of the violence is pretty explicit and pretty, pretty shocking, I guess. I mean, it's stuff that would only be written as pretty serious domestic abuse in a modern novel.
Yeah.
Or
again, if you have a character hanging a puppy, then including a sex scene, like, people wouldn't even blink at that.
Yeah. True. Like, hanging a puppy, we have a weird way of sorting what is considered appropriate and not appropriate in our media anyway. So you're like, oh, yeah, someone gets murdered, like, that's the least bad. Someone getting domestically abused would be slightly worse. Hanging a puppy would be worse than that, and raping someone would be the worst of all. And it's like, well, I'm not sure that's the same order I would choose.
I was working with a student on a paper yesterday, and it was about the TV show Hannibal, which I haven't seen. But she said that she was reading up on it, and I guess there's a scene where there's a serial killer in the show who cuts the skin on people's backs so that he can then pull it out like this big flap, and he like makes it set up so it looks like they have wings, like made out of their own skin. It's really weird.
That's very strange.
Yes, and so they were talking to like the censor about this scene where you're going to see these like dead bodies, and the censor was like, honestly, all of your setup is okay, except that the people are naked and we can see their butts. He's like, so if you put more blood over where their butts are so you can't really see the butts,
Jesus,
then it's fine to put on television. And I was like, murder people who have been flayed, totally cool. A butt, not okay. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, what are we doing?
So maybe we're a little more Victorian than we think we are.
Maybe we are. I'm reminded of that George Carlin bit where he suggests that you take all the movie dialogue where people are threatening to kill, where a character's threatening to kill somebody, and you replace it with the word fuck and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, Sheriff, we're gonna fuck you. We're gonna fuck you real slow.
That would just be funny.
I think that was kind of his point. Like, why are we hung up on this one thing and not on this other thing, which is pretty easily worse.
Yeah. So, as far as other moral issues go, Ben, you brought up revenge.
I brought up revenge mainly because every time there's a story where revenge is a strong thread, the theme of the story is almost always, don't get revenge.
Unless you read The Princess Bride.
Well, yes. Which we should podcast, actually, sometime.
Yeah.
Revenge in this story is certainly not presented in a good light, but it's really not the point of it. It's more just, Heathcliff is getting this revenge because he's a dark dude.
Yeah. Because he's a monster.
Right. A monster, not making some explicit point about revenge, because if you're going to make your point about revenge being a bad thing, usually you start with a character who is, if not fully good, at least mostly sympathetic, and then they become the monster.
Yeah. Whereas Heathcliff has been an a-hole all along.
Yeah. Maybe Heathcliff got more revenge, he would have turned good eventually. I don't know.
Nice. I like it.
So, just going to touch on a couple of things. We already talked about puppies being hanged, which happens twice, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up.
It's easily the book with the most puppy hanging that I've ever read. I actually wanted to talk a little bit about the supernatural elements aside from spontaneous pregnancy 1 week before you give birth. And that's that in Lockwood's chapter two, when he's staying at Wuthering Heights, there's a ghost. And at first it's like, you kind of wonder if it's a dream sort of thing, but by the end of the episode, I was convinced that it actually happened, like a weird cold hand tried to yank him through the window or something, and he bruised and bloodied himself escaping from it, and like the voices and the bizarre crap from reading Catherine's scrawled notes in the margin of a book or something.
Yeah, I agree.
And so that was, I thought that was going to have more to do with what was going on. That actually might be a scene that if there was a good editor might have just not made it into the draft. Or would have had to have been referenced again later, because it doesn't really have much to do with anything. I mean,
or is it about how the spirit of Catherine Earnshaw is haunting Wuthering Heights?
Yeah, I mean, there's the one scene where Heathcliff basically prays that she'll be a ghost because he'd rather have her around haunting him than gone forever, I think.
Yeah.
But it was so much later that it was hard to tie those two things together immediately. And then the other thing was, at some point, you know, roughly a decade, I think, after Kathy the Elder dies, Heathcliff has her exhumed, and when they open the lid to the coffin, apparently she looks exactly like she did when she was buried. Can't come up with the word all of a sudden. No degradation.
Decay.
No decay. There we go. No decay of the body at all. Still, like, with a look on her face as if she had just gone to sleep or something. Rosy cheeks. And that was strange. I'm not actually sure what was trying to be said there, but his takeaway was, oh, well, I need to leave, like, an open panel on the side of her coffin, so when I'm buried next to her, we can, like, our undead corpses can reach our hands through our coffins and hold hands for eternity or something.
Something like that.
Something like that.
I wouldn't put it past him.
Me neither.
Yeah, it was maybe, you know, the bit that helped makes the story feel a bit gothic and makes all of the total weirdness, like, it fits in with just the total, like, trip that the novel is.
Yeah.
So one thing that I just kind of wanted to talk about briefly was thinking about the Brontes and how they lived, because I listened to a podcast about the Brontes, Stuff You Missed in History Class, which is awesome. And it just talked about the three sisters who wrote books and where they grew up and blah, blah, blah. So basically, kind of the moral of their story is that their lives were, like, super depressing. So they're originally six Bronte kids, five girls, one boy. Two of the sisters died super young of, you know, like, tuberculosis or consumption or whatever. So then you had the three sisters and their brother and their father, and their mom was already dead, so, like, their aunt came and lived with them. And I think it was something about where they were living was just bad for your health, but basically all of them just kind of died off. Their dad died and their aunt died pretty young. Their brother, I think, more, like, drank himself to death than by virtue of, like, the environment around them, but he died really young. And then Emily, I think, both died before they hit 30. I want to say Emily Bronte died when she's, like, 29. And then Charlotte, who wrote Jane Eyre, she lived the longest, and she still died before she hit the age of 40. So the fact that so many of the characters in this book are dying super young and randomly getting sick or being sickly seemed a little more seemed a little less random when I kind of thought about it in context of their family life and how Emily would be like, well, everyone I have known and love is randomly getting sick and dying off super young, so that's what happens to people.
Yeah, and so I made a list of the characters, and actually I was trying to make a little, like, a chart showing what the different relationships were, and I have a very rough draft that is not all that clever, but I was going through it to see who was dead by the end, and it's pretty much everybody. So they're the elder Earnshaws, who are both dead in late enough middle age that it's not crazy for the 19th century. The Lintons both get sick and die within like 2 weeks of each other.
Uh-huh.
Hindley dies, you know, definitely not super young, but not when he's old.
His wife dies really young.
Yeah, she does. And Kathy the Elder dies pretty young, and Isabella dies pretty young, and Edgar dies when he's like 40, and Heathcliff is like the oldest surviving member of the cast who ends up being dead, and he's probably only, I mean, he can't possibly be more than like 50 when that happens.
Yeah.
Joseph is like 116 and is just too mean to die. Linton dies when he's like 16 or 17.
Yep.
Lockwood and Nellie both have extended illnesses at some point.
True.
Like, everybody is sick and dying in this book. Harriton and Kathy the Younger, I think, are the only two who don't at least have an extended illness.
Yeah, they're young and vibrant and full of life and doing fine.
And young is apparently defined as under 20, and old is apparently defined as over 29.
Yeah. Yeah, so, following the proud tradition of classics where everyone dies.
Yes.
But I mean, it's not really fair. Like, I don't like the whole, let's look at the author biography and see how it affected their writing, but this is the only book she ever wrote, and she wrote it, like, I think she went off and tried to be a governess or something for a short amount of time, but came back home pretty quickly. So she basically lived at home her whole life, wrote this book while she was living at home, and then died really young. So I don't think it's, like, out of the realm of possibility to say that she was influenced by that.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to read too deeply into an author biography, but certainly you write what you know.
Yeah.
So... should we get into the writing itself for a moment here?
Yeah.
So both of us, I think, agree that it would have benefited from some editing.
Yes.
This was like a found and published as is manuscript. Is that what the deal was?
Yeah, I think it was published after she died, but. Yeah, Charlotte Bronte, who at that point had already published Jane Eyre, just published it as was.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about a couple of the confusing elements of it. Just some of the narration within narration stuff maybe could have been made just one level of secondhand narration instead of two, or... like maybe Nellie could have been the framing character and Lockwood is unnecessary, or maybe some of the weird supernatural stuff never makes it into the final draft unless it's going to have significance in some other place in the book, so it has a reason to exist.
Yeah, I could see an editor be like, that's odd, maybe you should put that in a little more, just take it out. But Ben and I both did agree also that The one possible drawback to this book being edited at the time it was written was that a Victorian editor might have been not the best editor for the book.
What is all of this?
Yeah, because they'd be like, oh dear, that's much too much. But that's the thing, like a level, like they could have maybe found a level-headed editor who was like, oh yeah, I like how this is pushing boundaries and just like helped craft it, because I think every single book ever written benefits from an editor before it is published, personally. Because people looking at your stuff who aren't you see things that you would never see, and it's very helpful, so.
Well, we've read books by authors who have sold all of the copies. You know, J.K. Rowling, a couple of those middle volume Harry Potters, or Stephen King, I can't remember things today. The apocalyptic one, Gabs, help me.
The Stand?
Thank you, Jesus. Those were very long books by authors who have sold multiple millions of copies of books, and some of those would have benefited from a little bit more of an editor saying no to them.
Yes. And just, like, as an editor myself, I have definitely worked with people, even having my own stuff edited, maybe coming from that perspective, like, when I write the first draft of something sometimes, I'm like, this is pretty good, and then an editor will come back and be like, here's, like, 20 things to change, and you're kind of like, shit, and then you change all those things, and you're like, oh my god, this is so much better than the first one. And I've seen that happen a lot with people that I work with, too, when you make suggestions. Like, I never thought of that, and they change it. And they're like, it's like with students on papers, when you help them recraft their introductions a lot of the time and write a new thesis, when they go back and look at it, they're like, holy crap, it actually says what I mean now. So, yeah, I think Wuthering Heights could have done with an editor who actually worked with Emily Bronte, as opposed to just saying, like, I'm going to cut out all the stuff I find distasteful.
Right. These aren't people politely drinking tea together. We must cut it all.
Yeah.
And then on the, you know, the good side of the ledger, there are some pretty cold, brutal and direct insults that get tossed back and forth in some of these scenes of people arguing. And I don't know if it ever, like, approaches the level of, like, a wonderfully crafted, memorable Shakespearean insult, but there are a lot of conversations where, like, people will say ridiculously brutal things to each other back and forth for, like, 5 exchanges in a row, and you don't even realize until you, like, a page later that that was cold-blooded.
Yeah.
It's, like, so common that you almost forget it's there sometimes.
Yeah, even to a modern reader, some of those exchanges, it's like, damn, those people are good. they're throwing some serious shade. It's good stuff.
I know, like a longer life and some editorial oversight, and maybe Emily Bronte can write the next, like, Darcy Elizabeth level of exchange. Except ruder.
Yeah, I was like, a slightly more asshole-y Darcy and Elizabeth.
I feel like I could enjoy that.
I feel like I could, too. And Elizabeth, who instead of being like, oh no, Lydia ran away, like, when Lydia comes back, she just, like, eviscerates her.
Right? Just rips her down to the foundation.
I'm okay with that.
You thoughtless tart, let me give you 7 reasons why you suck.
And then when Wickham tries to talk to her, she's like, back off, bitch.
So my question about this book was just, WTF, mate? I don't even...
I kind of had the same lingering feeling, and I think my main problem with it was, like, when I think about my enjoyment of the book overall, I didn't really like it that much. It had some, like, interesting threads clearly to talk about, but I despise Heathcliff. I thought he was really annoying. I just wanted someone to, like, hit him in the face. But the other thing that just really, really confused me about the book was it was so polar opposite of what I was expecting based on what I'd heard people say about it that I, like, had no idea where it was going and where it ended up. I was just like, that made no sense to me. Why do people talk about this book the way they do.
Yeah, I don't know why people talk about this book the way they do. Maybe it's just a sign that when a book gets to classic, like, capital C status, that for some reason, opinions about it have to get solidified in a way that people don't question it as hard as they should.
Yeah, I don't know. All I know is that the several people I told that we were doing a podcast about Wuthering Heights were all like, ugh, hated that book. So, it's pretty common, I think, for people not to like it.
So, I mean, in that vein, our verdict, I found it pretty unpleasant to read. I didn't really enjoy the experience that much, and I would just say I would not recommend it. Even to the person who likes to catch up on their classics, just pick a different one.
I think Ben and I would both safely say read Jane Eyre instead.
Oh, yeah, that was 1,000 times better.
Which we both actually really liked.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I was just confused. I was hating on Heathcliff so much I could barely stand it. And after the fact, when I thought about it, I was like, I can appreciate some of it, but overall it was just kind of a struggle, and I was glad to get through it.
Yes. Probably, almost certainly would not have gotten through it if it was not for podcasting purposes.
You're welcome.
So, well, you know, we both take our turn with that sometimes, I think. So, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading Salvage the Bones by Jessamyn Ward. She is, I believe, a black author, and this book won the National Book Award several years ago. It's about a family in Mississippi. And I don't know if a hurricane actually hits or if the father's just obsessed with a hurricane hitting, but that is, like, one of the major threats happening right now. And they're fairly impoverished, and it's just, there are several things going on. I don't really know where they're going because I'm not very far into the book yet. But it's part of my efforts. I want to read more authors who are not white. And so I had some people who I trust their opinions recommend some good books to me that I'm going to start reading so that I can stop being such a whitey white person.
Which I think is a good goal. You'll probably see some of that reflected in podcast choices for a while. We try to do a little bit of that anyway, but, you know, I can't say that my current book choice is in that vein, though, as I am reading The New World by Michael Stackpole, which is the third book in a fantasy trilogy that at the beginning, the beginning of the first book was something along the lines of, what if there was cartography magic in ancient China analog? And now here in the third book is more along the lines of the gods are crazy and fighting each other.
I would not expect that.
Yeah. So it's been interesting because of the large changes in, I guess, setting and background that happened from volume to volume. But at the same time, I am very much in a different place than where I was in the first book. So, if you have any comments or questions or suggestions, especially on the good books written by non-white, non-males side of things...
Yes.
You can leave a comment on the website, which is novelideaspodcast.com.
You can tweet novelideas at novelideaspod, or you can tweet me at classicsumup.
If you even remember that there was an email for a while, there isn't anymore, so don't do that. And we are presumably still on iTunes, though. I can't say I really look at that either.
We are on iTunes. I looked recently, okay. And we are.
Woohoo! Yeah.
We don't actually know what we're going to be reading next time, so that's going to be a fun mystery for everyone.
That's true. We have a couple of episodes backlog that might toss one of those up next, but I'm not going to promise that, because every time I do, I do not follow through.
Yeah, I think we have several mysterious episodes that we've referenced multiple times that have never seen the light of day.
We have at least four, though one of those intentionally will never see the light of day.
I know exactly which one you're talking about, too.
Yeah, if that was going to see the light of day, then people are going to have to raise funds for us or something. And then they can finally know why Bryony is a spaz. But until that day comes, I think that is going to do it, and we will see you next time.
Bye.